job in my career that I felt I did the least well. He was an incredibly clever corporate raider. We didn't learn the lessons from the FM split when it came to DAB.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Simon Cole.
I grew up in North Lancashire, in Burnley and Blackburn, and therefore count myself as not a metropolitan guy. Went to school in Blackburn, and my father was a brewer. He ran small independent breweries, and I think I inherited some things from him, because in his life he went from one small independent brewery to another, and in each occasion they were taken over by a bigger company and he left to go to another small family brewery. He didn't like working for big concerns. He liked, you know, working for a small place where I think he knew people's names and, you know, etc., etc. So very comfortable life, two loving parents. I'm very grateful for that, and I'm particularly grateful for one thing my mother did for me, which will always stick with me as something I credit her with, and something also I credit a man called John Musgrave for. John Musgrave was the manager of BBC Radio Blackburn, as it was at the time. When I was a child in Blackburn, I was a teenager, I think I was 15 or 16, my first foray into radio was that I took a drum of cable, which a telecom engineer had left behind on the road, ran it down the fence between all our houses and ran wires off into everybody's house with a loudspeaker on. And together with a mate of mine called Mick, who also lived on the road, we ran Avenue Broadcasting from our shed with a disco deck and a couple of amplifiers. This got in the local paper and got the interest of BBC Radio Blackburn. I went down for an interview on their kids' Saturday programme or whatever.
This is BBC Radio Blackburn serving you, the people of North East Lancashire.
Then another very influential man in my life, Gerald Jackson, who's still working at the BBC, took me to one side and said, listen, would you like to come and do some stuff here on a Saturday? So as a 15-year-old, I started reclaiming tape on a Saturday at Radio Blackburn. And then I was doing station assistant shifts during my A-levels, and I used to do the 2 o'clock continuity announcement. I thought it was because they wanted me to do it, and then I discovered it was because they were all at the pub and they didn't want to come home early for back to the studio after lunch. You know, I got the radio bug. Radio Blackburn,
Radio Blackburn, Radio. Here's your station manager, John Musgrave.
They are not idle words when we say this is BBC Radio Blackburn serving you, the people of North East Lancashire.
After I did my A-levels, I had a place to read drama at Manchester University. John Musgrave, who was the manager of Radio Blackburn, had a station assistant's job coming up. And he asked me whether I wanted it. And I said, well, yes, you know, I'd really love it. So I went home and excitedly told my mother that I didn't need to go to university anymore because I'd got a job, and that was fantastic because that's where my horizons were. She didn't say anything to try and dissuade me, but she rang up John Musgrave, who she didn't know, and she said, just want you to know that my son did have a place at Manchester University, and that's fine. You offering him his job is meaning that he's not going to take that place. The next day, Musgrave calls me in and he says, by the way, I didn't ask you, did you apply for university? And I said, yes, I did. I got a place at Manchester, but I don't need that anymore because you've given me a job. He said, well, I'm not going to have it on my conscience that I stopped a child going to university. So you can have the job in 3 years' time if you still want it, but you're going to university. And I was devastated. And it was years before my mum told me her involvement in that. But it was a fantastic thing for her to do and for him to do, because without that, you know, who knows, I might still be a station assistant in BBC local radio. Radio Manchester, BBC. Whilst being at university, I had only intended to work in radio. But I did a degree in drama, which was, I did because I was interested in drama, and frankly, it was what I could get into university to do. I happened to be very fortunate to be in a great year at Manchester University. My co-students were Rick Mayall, Aid Edmondson, Ben Elton, Dave Laveau, people who've gone on to be very successful in the theatre and entertainment world. And even then, as 19, 21-year-olds, they were all very talented and determined individuals. And while I was at Manchester, we ran a semi-professional theatre company because I was the only person on the course who didn't want to do acting or directing or stage management. I didn't mind. I was happy to do posters and tickets and organise everything, which nobody else wanted to do. So we had this little company and we went to the Edinburgh Festival 2 years running. We won the Student Drama Festival in Durham. And the last thing we did was we hired the Royal Exchange Theatre in Manchester to put on a play written by one of the students, Sherlock's Last Case. Just before the last night, the publicity director of the Royal Exchange introduced herself to me. She said, I've watched what you've done here. She said, I'm looking for a deputy and I'll give you the job now on the spot. I don't care what degree you get, but I'd like you to come and work for me. I had a real choice to make because, you know, I'd always thought I was going to work in radio, but I had actually got a bit of a bug for the theatre. So I accepted her job on the condition that I could still freelance at the BBC. So I went from being a student freelancing at the BBC to being Deputy Publicity Director of the Royal Exchange, still freelancing at the BBC.
We're in Altrincham. We've got the Sportsline studio here, making a little bit of history as far as both Radio Manchester and Altrincham are concerned, because it's the first time the Sportsline phone-in...
Radio Manchester was a place of great vibrancy because it had moved into this new facility. New Broadcasting House opened while I was at university. It was at that point the state-of-the-art facility, Mark III desks, at the time cutting-edge technology. It had all the normal things that I associate with the BBC. You know, the BBC has a particular working culture, which over 30 years I've seen in many different places. It doesn't change that much, and it has great positives and some negatives. For me, it was the best broadcasting school in the world. You were in the network production centre, you could go to the canteen and network with people who were in regional TV, network radio, absolutely fabulous place. So for me, it was a kind of cathedral of broadcasting. You know, I'd been at BBC Radio Blackburn, which was based in an old car showroom in the centre of Blackburn where the roof leaked. And there I was now freelancing in this gleaming new facility. I was co-presenting a morning programme on Radio Manchester with a presenter called Alan Yardley. It was your usual mixed magazine, music, interview, news, etc., etc. That arrangement continued, but it came to a head... I must have been 22, and Radio 1 were looking for somebody to stand in for Mike Reed on his evening show.
After the Buzzcocks, we're going to take a dive back to January 1967. The Snow Dice and Wife Sugar, led by the very able guitarist Diesel Martin.
They'd approached Radio Manchester and said, would you like to suggest somebody? I think I was probably the only person under 45 at the radio station. So they suggested me. Nobody told me that. And I'm sitting there at the Royal Exchange and Derek Chinnery's office phone. And I think it's a joke. So I said, yeah, give me a number, I'll call you back. So I called him back. It was Derek Chinnery's office and he was saying, we'd like you to audition to stand in for Mike Reed for a week on Radio 1. So cut a long story short, I did it. But that week doing Radio 1 made me realise two crucial things. First of all, I was never going to get radio out of my blood. And secondly, I was never going to be the world's greatest presenter. There were going to be people who were better than me. I was never going to be in that top 0.5%. And, you know, I've definitely seen that in the world of presentation, you're either in that top 5% or, you know, by the time you're 50, you're, you know, presenting somewhere where you don't want to be presenting. But I enjoyed it. I absolutely loved it. I was freelance at Radio Manchester, but I was a contract freelance. And a full-time job came up as a station assistant. And I applied for it, and somebody else who will remain nameless applied for it. The other person who applied for it, shall we say, was significantly older than me. I felt I was, you know, the job should have been mine. And after the board, they called me back in. And they said, well, you're the person for the job, clearly. We'd like to give it to you. But you must understand, Candidate X needs the job more than you. Because he's older than you and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So what we're going to do is we're going to give him the job and you can wait for the next one to come up. I so didn't understand that and I was just mortified. And the news editor at Radio Manchester at the time was a lady called Diana Veer. She was married, ironically, to the news editor of Piccadilly, which was the subject of some angst at Radio Manchester. I mean, Diana quite liked me. I used to drive the lunchtime news programme and, you know, I think I was reasonably good at it. She said, oh, God, this guy, they didn't give him the job. They gave it to so-and-so and, you know, he's really pissed off. David Veer went back and mentioned this to Colin Walters, who was running Piccadilly. Colin phoned me up a couple of days later. He said, I know, you know, Colin is a person of massive influence in my life, but very blunt. I'm Colin Walters, run Piccadilly Radio, you may know me. He said, I understand you're a bit pissed off at the moment with the BBC. So I said, well, you know, I didn't get the job. He said, do you want to have a pizza? And over the pizza, he said, do you want to come and work at Piccadilly? And I thought, yes, I think I do, because I think it's very flattering to be offered a job. My concern was that I wanted to come back to the BBC. I mean, at that point in life, and it's funny, as you go through life, you always have things that you're aiming for, don't you? And funnily enough, rarely do you ever end up doing the things you've aimed for. You end up doing something else while you're on the way there. My aim at the time was to produce on Radio 2. That was what I wanted to do, to be a Radio 2 producer. I was being told, if you take this job at Piccadilly, you'll never come back. You know, you've gone to the dark side. So I did a cheeky thing. I had seen and knew a guy called Michael Green, who at the time was head of the Network Production Centre in Manchester. I didn't know him from Adam, but I'd seen him in the canteen and I knew where his office was. And, you know, it's part of that thing of New Broadcasting House being, you know, the hub that it was. Why don't I ask him whether I'd ever come back to the BBC or whether if I do this, I'm burning my bridges here. He sat me down for an hour. This is the head of Network Production Centre, and I'm a 23-year-old station assistant who's just not got a job at Radio Manchester. In the time between me fixing the appointment and him seeing me, he'd found out a bit about me, and he said to me, listen, he said, you really don't need to worry about coming back. In 2-3 years' time, you could come back. He said, but I'm telling you now, you never will. You're a commercial radio guy. Unfortunately, you're the kind of guy that we are losing from the BBC to commercial radio because we don't have anywhere to capture youth, energy, whatever. He said, so I'm really sorry that you're leaving, but I promise you, you won't come back. And of course, he was right. And I never made that job of producer at Radio 2. So I guess I'm massively disappointed with my underachievement. But it was on several occasions in life, I've encountered people who have a quality which I've always tried to emulate and which I respect above all others, which is the ability to give people time and to respect potential. You know, we never know who the next great leader is until we've spent time with somebody who at the moment might not look like they're going to be the next great thing. The transition from the BBC to commercial radio at that point was like stepping off one planet onto another. But I immediately found it very exciting. Michael Green was right. I was immediately stimulated by the commercial atmosphere, by the go-to attitude of the place, the aggression. It wasn't, you know, Piccadilly was not the friendliest place. I went from a place where there was a veneer of everything being lovely and organised and friendly, but it was a veneer because underneath it there was an awful lot of politics going on, to a place where if somebody didn't like you, they just told you. Very quickly, I learnt the balance between the sales department and the programming department in commercial radio, which is obviously I'd never come across that. I produced The Breakfast Show as one of my early jobs. I used to come in, therefore, in the company Mini Metro with Piccadilly emblazoned all over it. So I had this lovely little car. And because I came in at 5:30 in the morning, all of the car parking spaces on the top of the piazza were free. So I would park on the one next to the escalator. After I'd been doing this for a couple of weeks, Bert Tatlock, who was then the sales director, came to see me. And he said, you know what? You're parking in my space every day. I said, sorry, but I didn't know it was your space. It's not labelled. He said, well, it's next to the escalator. It's the best space. I'm sales director. I get the best space because I pay the bills. And he was just straightforward about it. And I thought, well, that was slightly shocking, but correct. I learned then about that tension that goes on in any commercial radio station between the commercial side and the programming side. But I found all that stimulating. And I was very lucky. You know, I've been lucky to happen to be amongst a very talented group of people. Timmy Mallett, Mike Sweeney, Andy Bird, who you probably won't know, who I employed as a work experience student. I mean, there's one. You know, he came to us from Newcastle University wanting summer work, and I thought he was a really bright kid. He ended up being chairman of Disney International and the most senior non-American in American media. Amazingly talented. Andy Crane, you know, Piccadilly at that time had an amazing group. And of course, Chris Evans. Chris Evans was a Timmy helper. And Timmy Mallett's evening programme was literally an academy for radio starters. 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 22,
24, 26, 28, 30. Oh, bollocks, I lost out.
Meanwhile, Rojo, chucking on through there now.
It's all right, Mr. Bang.
One of Timmy's great qualities is he's inspirational to young people. He has an ability to connect with young enthusiasm. His show, which ran from, I think, 6:30 till 10, the control room was stuffed with teenagers and work experience people. I mean, stuffed. There were hundreds of them. There were people there who've gone on to be in the industry in a variety of things, and we didn't pay them anything. That would never have happened at BBC Radio Manchester, because the BBC would have gone, "Whoa, hang on, you know, all these people need paying," or, you know. Commercial radio was, to some extent in those days, the Wild West, and commercially it was still finding its feet. I mean, these were the days when Capital had nearly gone bust and Piccadilly didn't have the easiest commercial ride to start with. But I was there in the period where commercial radio found its feet. You could walk down Market Street in Manchester and know that nearly 50% of everybody in that city, 2 million people, was listening to your radio station. You know, that is an incredible feeling. And I don't think we knew at that point just how amazingly fortunate that was. Piccadilly Radio leads
the way. If I was managing director of that radio station all over again, what I would do is I would have to be much more structured in what I asked my programme controller to do, in terms of, both in terms of audience achievement, but also in terms of the sort of radio station I was looking for.
I said earlier that the thing about the culture of commercial radio is that people called a spade a spade. Well, Colin epitomised that. You didn't mess with him. You knew where you stood. If he didn't like what you were doing, he told you. One of my first lessons from Colin was, one of my very early jobs, I was producing Gary Davis, another person from Piccadilly in those days, from that great group of people. And he was doing Drive Time. We had a competition where kids came on and they had to ask general knowledge questions. And I'd set the questions as producer. And one of the questions was, what was the capital of Germany? This was pre-unification. And I'd written the answer down as Berlin. And of course, the answer was Bonn. So the kid gave the answer Berlin. We said it was correct. He won the competition. The other kid's mum phoned up and said, "No, that's wrong. You got it wrong." We had to go on air, correct it, give the prize to the other guy. I'm like in the control room with my head in my hands. Colin comes through the door. So he said, "You're producing this, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Tell me, do we employ producers to make sure that mistakes like that don't happen?" I said, "Yeah, I think we do." He said, "Okay, just wanted to check. Thanks." And walked out. Which was his way of saying, don't ever let that happen again. Time after time, Colin demonstrated an amazing knack for spotting talent. It's not just luck that Piccadilly at that time had great people. Great people coalesce around great leaders. They coalesce around people who they think they will learn something from. He took a huge risk on me as head of programmes. I didn't apply for the head of programme job. I was senior producer. I was 26. I didn't think in a million years I could apply for a programme director's job. He took me upstairs to the Piccadilly Hotel for a drink one evening. He said, "You haven't applied for the job." I said, "Well, I can't. You know, I'm 26. I can't be programme director of a commercial radio station." He said, no, you can't. He said, "But you could be head of programmes and you could learn how to be a programme director." And he said, "If you wanted to do that, I'd take the risk on you." He nurtured me at a stage where I didn't have, and people who know me know this is rare for me, I didn't have the belief in myself that he had in me. And I really struggled with that job because I was being promoted above people who'd applied for the job and not got it, my colleagues. I was suddenly having to move to a management role where I wasn't part of the day-to-day team, I was in charge. And I found that really challenging. If I'm honest, it's the job in my career that I felt I did the least well. I learnt in that job what it takes to make a great program director. I learnt that whilst I could do it, there were people who could do it better. To be a great program director, you have to have an instinct about what the listening base wants, even if you are nothing like them. And that's a really amazing talent. Colin used to have a phrase which he said to us all, coming up to Piccadilly at the time from the Piccadilly Gardens, which was not the most glamorous part of Manchester at the time, there were two escalators that took you up to the building. And at the bottom of those escalators was Piccadilly, the bus station, the centre of Manchester, but not a terrific place. Colin used to say, what do they think about this at the bottom of the escalators? In other words, never mind what we think in this room, what do they think of this? He had a great knack for that. You know, he spotted that they would think Mike Sweeney was a fantastic idea. Or at least that 50% of them would probably hate him, but the 50% who loved him would really love him. And Mike would never have got a job on most radio stations. Would I have had the vision to hire Mike? Probably not. I would have done something more straightforward. And as head of programmes, I think I did a straightforwardly decent job. We all find it really easy to realise what we're good at. It's much more important to recognise what you're not good at and to stop concentrating on that.
228-6262, give us a ring. Tell me about your unusual or embarrassing party experiences and your unusual chat-up lines. But I must have successful chat-up lines. I'm not the slightest bit...
So there I was as head of programmes, and I went to America. And when I was there, I went to California and met a man called Norm Pattis, who at the time was running a company called Westwood One, which was pioneering networking in commercial radio, which was pretty nascent then. You know, I provide a radio station with free content, they give me airtime, I sell it. I came back to Piccadilly and I said to Colin, this is a really interesting business. You know, somebody should do this here, because at the time there were 22 commercial radio stations, nobody shared anything. Everybody did their own programs 24 hours a day. This is before the network charter. Colin thought it was a great idea. And at the time, unbeknown to me, the network chart show was being talked about between him, Nigel Walmsley, and several other people in commercial radio. But it was being done as an industry-led thing. And Colin, in his typical commercially savvy way, thought, well, this is great, but actually, if we could do this networking thing on our own, we could make all the money. He came to me and said, I'd like you to set up something like that. And I, at first, said to him, no, I don't want to do that because I've got the head of programs job, and that's a job I'm, you know, it's a dream job to me. So I said, no, I don't want to do it. So he, again, made me, like those great people in your life, John Musgrave, Michael Green, he persuaded me that what he knew was good for me was the right thing for me to do. So we set up Piccadilly Productions and Marketing, 100% owned by Piccadilly, to explore network programmes in commercial radio. And at the same time as the network chart was being launched, presented by David Jensen and sponsored by Nescafe,
the very first network chart show coming at you right across the nation on independent radio,
Piccadilly Productions and Marketing went out and did the Pepsi American chart show and the network album show. Now, there was an awful lot of industry politics about that, because what Colin was doing, and he had a reputation for this at a senior level, was he was being a little bit of somebody, some people would call him a cowboy. He was taking what had been agreed amongst the leaders of the industry and he was privatising it effectively. And the principle was very, really simple. Pepsi paid for the show. You put out Pepsi credits, you get a free show. Wow. I wish it had stayed as simple as that. Anyway, we got the American chart show on, I don't know, I can't remember how many stations, but it was most of the network. Pepsi were very pleased. So PPM Radio Waves, as it was then called, became successful as the pioneer of sponsored network programmes. Those were the days when sponsorship was brand new. You could, you know, Nescafe was the first one, and you had to say in association with, and you had to, you know, now one of the things we did with Pepsi, it was the first named sponsorship. So it was the Pepsi American Chart Show. And that was a big deal. And Coca-Cola's agency went absolutely ape over the fact they'd been allowed to do that. And the way we did it is we went to the IBA, Paul Brown, the regulator at that time, and we said, listen, the chart is owned by Pepsi. They bought the chart. So what Pepsi did in order to make this happen is I said to Pepsi, you go and buy the Radio and Records chart. So it becomes in the UK the Pepsi chart. You own it. It's yours. So I said to the IBA, the Football League had a sponsor. And I said, well, we're just doing the same thing. The chart's owned by Pepsi, so we're calling the program the Pepsi chart because that's what it is. And in the end, they gave in, which McCann Erickson, Murray Dudgeon, who was the media director there, absolutely furious about it because Pepsi had got a major thing over over Coca-Cola, which is always a big aim of theirs.
I am a prisoner, Benny Brown, setting you free every week with the American Countdown. There's a lot going on. It's a hot summertime musically across the Atlantic. We're rolling towards a new number one. We'll just keep on moving with Soul to Soul.
So that began to flourish. I didn't own any of it. And I, at the time, I had no concept of the idea that I was creating a business here for Colin. And, you know, I didn't have a stake in it. I mean, you know, I was, what was I, 28 or something. I really enjoyed it. Again, this was actually what I was supposed to do, you know, because this was a combination of creativity and business and a bit of a kind of Wild West pushing at the frontier. It was great to succeed.
From the heart of Manchester, this is Key 103.
You're in tune with Britain's first 24-hour all-FM radio station.
Key 103. Music, not music.
Frequency splitting happened at the same time as the formation of PPM. I was on the way out of being head of programmes. I certainly don't want to disassociate myself from what was a disaster. The launch of Key 103 and the decision to put the main radio station on medium wave and change the FM was a disastrous decision. Capital did exactly the same thing with CFM. People thought of FM in the way they then again thought of DAB in the same way as something new, and therefore not many people would listen to it, and therefore we should put our experimental stuff on that, which was completely the wrong thing to do. So whilst I'd been involved in the decision-making process that got us there, I wasn't there. It was very much Colin's baby. Now, to me, that doesn't dent at all my view of Colin Walters. You know, I'm a great believer in the Henry Ford maxim of business. Failure is the opportunity to begin again more intelligently. In Britain, we look on failure as something that's terminal. The Americans don't. They look at it as a learning process. And I think we would be more innovative sometimes, and we would handle innovation better if we didn't think so badly of failing. Failing at Key 103 was definitely instructional. Failing, I mean, I don't think many of the FM splits were a success. I don't take the travails of, you know, 103 today. 103 did go through a good period, a very good period. The splitting of frequencies could be marked as the start of the erosion of the mass market stations like Piccadilly. But that wasn't just because of the split, because that the split of FMAM came just before new licenses awarded. You were the only game in town broadcasting the same thing on both frequencies to 40% of the population. A bunch of things changed that over the next 10 years. Splitting the frequencies was part of it. I do think, and you know, as you know, I have bruises all over my body from DAB. And I do think we didn't learn the lessons from the FM split when it came to DAB, because I think the industry did exactly the same again. The basic economics of taking an audience which is listening to one thing on two frequencies and make them listen to two things on two different frequencies involves a doubling of costs and therefore an assumption that you are going to double the audience. And that isn't going to happen, not in a million years. And it was a huge mistake. The industry is still recovering from that today. What's happened now, ironically, is we've effectively gone back to the 80s. We've gone back to market-leading national brands
that stand out. So if I'm in Manchester now, Capital stands out because it's got marketing, it's got, you know, a national format, etc., etc. I know all the arguments about national versus local, and, you know, I'm with that, and I'm with the sadness of losing local radio. But economically, what Global did was effectively put back into commercial radio the thing we used to have in the 80s, dominant brands that everybody knew and everybody talked about in the office, replacing a marketplace in Manchester at one point which had, you know, 14 different commercial radio brands. Doesn't make sense.
Owen Oyston is keen to expand his communications business at a time when the fortunes of local radio are changing considerably. The Miss World Group, which was formed last year, already owns 40% of Piccadilly, although it has no voting shares. It also operates radio stations in Preston, Leeds, Cardiff and the south of France. Owen Oyston believes a merger involving Red Rose and Piccadilly would create a strong northwest base, and he denies he's intervened now
the
to block...
The takeover by Owen of Piccadilly was another instructional chapter change in my life, and probably tells you something about the way I work. I had been brought up in the northwest of England. I'd seen Owen's estate agencies. My father was in business by that time in Manchester. So Owen was known to me. And I watched the way he took over Piccadilly. Now, I now realise with hindsight, he was an incredibly clever corporate raider. Piccadilly was public at the time. It had been one of the first radio companies to go on what was then called the unlisted securities market. And it had done well. It had a shareholding structure which in theory made a takeover impossible. I won't bore you with the details of the structure, but in theory it was not possible for somebody to take the company over, and Owen worked out a way of doing it. In doing so, he undermined Colin and the board, and he used tactics, and, you know, I've been in business long enough to know that, you know, you don't have to be nice to succeed, that nobody expected were clever, you know, manipulated the position to his own desire. What I saw from my position was I saw him attacking Colin. I saw this as a personal attack on Colin, which it was, and he made some quite vicious personal attacks on Colin publicly at the time. That didn't go down well with me, and also my knowledge of Owen and history in the Northwest caused me, the moment the takeover was complete, to write him a letter saying, I'm leaving. So I resigned the following day. He spent a few days trying to persuade me to stay. Once he knew I wouldn't stay, you know, the guns got turned. And he said, you know, you'll do 6 months notice, you won't take holiday, etc., etc., etc. Now, at the time, that was fine, because actually I didn't have a plan. You know, one of the reasons Phil Riley is such a great friend is that is the opposite of what Phil Riley would do. I had no plan. I had no clue what I was going to do. I just knew I didn't want to do this. Didn't want to work in that environment. But what then happened was Nigel Walmsley called me up, who I knew vaguely because he was one of the people I'd been into with my briefcase full of cassettes to sell in Paul Gambaccini's American Chart Show. And, you know, I knew Nigel a bit. Sorry, I should explain that at the time, Tim Blackmore was freelancing with us at PPM. Tim was producing the programmes. And I had met Tim, who I regarded as a god in the radio industry, when I received a Sony Radio Award for a program called Mr. Halley's Band, which won Best Classical Music Program. Tim had been chair of the judging panel and came up to me afterwards and said, that was one of the best pieces of radio, blah, blah, blah. And I was like in awe. You know, this is Tim Blackmore, one of the founders of Radio 1, of Capital. When we formed PPM Radio Waves, therefore, I wanted Tim to be my creative genius. And he was. So I was held to my 6 month notice. And Tim worked along with me as a freelance. Nigel phoned up and said, well, I assume you and Tim are going to start out on your own. I assume that's what you're doing. And I just wanted you to know, if you're doing that, we'd be really interested in investing. So Tim and I met in the Russell Square Hotel over a drink. And I said, Nigel Walmsley's made this phone call. And Tim said, well, he said, funnily enough, Noel Edmonds phoned me and said the same thing. Noel was an old friend of Tim's. We kind of had our two foundation investors, but they were telling us what the idea was. So anyway, we did that, and we didn't say anything about the fact we were going to launch a business until the week before the end of my notice period at PPM, because I knew that, you know, there'd be war with Owen. you know, there was nothing Owen could do. We'd tied everything up really well. And in fact, 6 months later, they ended up selling us the assets of PPM for, I think, £1. And, you know, Unique ended up being what PPM had been. So it was my first corporate transaction, if you like, where I was the owner and I was taking assets from somebody else. So it was another important, you know, learning part of my life. And then, you know, Unique was born. So that was 1989. And Unique then carried on the work that PPM had been doing, developed it. And a lot of people look at Unique now and think it was a pioneer of BBC independent production. Well, it was, but it didn't start like that. Unique started and was for 2 or 3 years a commercial radio company. It made sponsored programs and earned money from advertisers. Independent production in this country was pioneered by commercial radio. I'm involved in a lot of lobbying where the BBC has been on the other side in the last, you know, 20 years of independent production. And at all occasions, the BBC likes to tell government and everybody that independent production only exists because of the BBC. That's certainly not true in the case of Unique. Now, the original model of simply stick a sponsor's name on the programme and give it to the radio stations for free quickly ran out of steam when the radio stations realised they could sell sponsorship themselves, and actually this sponsorship was worth more than the advertising. So wait a minute, these guys need to pay us some of this money. So the whole model got much more complicated than it was originally, and sponsorship became not that special. We felt we needed to move the model on, and we needed to go again in the direction that of the travel that America had gone. And rather than go for sponsorship, actually take airtime out of the programme and sell the airtime. We did that first with a thing called the Financial Times Business News Network. And that was because ABC Radio in the States, who'd been doing the Wall Street Journal, and at the time had just taken a shareholding in Satellite Media Services, which was the distributor of commercials in the UK, came to us and said, well, why is the Wall Street Journal report, why is something like that not happening in the UK? And I said, well, really difficult to do because nobody does this thing where you retain airtime. So they said, well, if you want to have a go at that, we'd finance the development of a Financial Times Business News to match our Wall Street Journal. And we'd work with you to show you how to do this. I'd never sold advertising in my life. And it's very, very different from that sponsorship sales thing. So I thought the really difficult thing would be persuading stations to give us a little bit of inventory in the business news. At the time, stations had to do business news because it was a tick in the box for whoever the regulator was. So we actually got on the stations quite easily, and I managed to persuade stations to give up airtime. Now, that was a very interesting dynamic because that took me right back into the programming versus sales, you know, atmosphere of Piccadilly. And again, I was able to use my learning experience early in commercial radio to understand that the sales director wasn't going to like this. Whatever happened, he or she was going to be against it. So we had to give the program director an awful lot of reasons to do this to overcome that. We actually got the stations, not easily, but we got them more easily than I thought we would. 22 stations on the Financial Times Business Network. And then I thought, well, all we do is we give this airtime to a sales house and they sell it. Bingo. So we gave the airtime to IRS at the time and they didn't sell it. 6 months went by. They'd hardly sold anything. And we were losing money and ABC were losing money. And Bob Callahan said to me, he said, you're doing this wrong. He said, if you want to develop anything in sales where what you're selling is different from what is currently sold, you need to have somebody whose life depends on selling it. And that view was validated by, I went to a sales presentation that IRS gave at an agency of the Financial Times Business News Network. And the sales executive concerned put the presentation in front of the media buyer. The media buyer had loads of negatives and blah, blah, blah. And I was sitting there thinking, okay, well, I know how to counter all those negatives. The sales executive said, okay, I've got something else. And promptly put our presentation back in his bag. Because I learned then that actually a great sales executive wants to leave the room with a deal. And if he's got something else that's going to get him the deal, then that's it. So I thought, actually, Bob's right. And at the time, I knew David Campbell very well, who was running Virgin Radio. He had an issue in that John Pearson and John Quinn were both at the radio station, and I don't think it's any secret, didn't get on. So David Campbell took me for a drink one night and said, he said, John Quinn's going to be leaving us. He's the man you want. He is the man who will solve your problem. John came in to see me And he was incredibly resistant to doing the job because he just left being a sales director at Virgin Radio. And as he said to me, and he always says this, Simon, you know, I've been at the top table in this industry, and now you're asking me to come here and sell this. You know, he thought of it as sort of remnant inventory. And I was offering him a desk and a phone and 20% of anything he sold. And that was that. But he decided to do it. Within 2 weeks, we were sold out. And that taught me a really big lesson about that sales thing, about when you're selling something new, your life has to depend on it. But this is pre the success of Newslink or anything like that. From that, we developed the barter business within Unique, which then moved on from doing Financial Times Business News Network to doing the traffic and travel, to doing entertainment news, etc., etc. Fast forward 6 or 7 years, and GTN came into the market to try and compete with us on traffic and travel. They spent 2 years trying to compete with us, and to be honest, they made our life really difficult because they were writing big checks for radio stations and, you know, trying to get us off them. But they didn't succeed. A combination of, you know, tenacity with John and I kept us on. And GTN in the end came to me and said, listen, okay, we can't beat you. How much to buy that bit of your business? At the time, we were about to invest in DAB. I felt if I could get a cash number from them that was significant, we should probably do that. The negotiation happened in Soho House, New York. I remember on one day with Bill Eade, who's the boss of GTN. This is another instrumental point of my life. My first negotiation with an American company on an asset sale, and my first inkling of the difference in American and British business cultures, which I've seen, you know, over the last 15 years since then. The differences in American and British business culture go fundamentally to the differences in our culture as to people. Americans are much more risk averse, much more, and if I use the word aggressive, I'm not using it in a negative way, determined. They're blunt, and especially, you know, GTN were very blunt. And you have to behave in a very un-British way sometimes to get things to happen. And I found the negotiation with GTN very stressful. Probably the first time in my life where I lost sleep over work, you know, because they really, you know, what they were doing was on the one hand negotiating with us and the other hand going to offer vast checks to radio stations. Anyway, we cut a deal, long story short, at 11 million. Now, John will tell you, he didn't want us to sell. He wanted to continue as we were going. And I have some sympathy for that. We were doing really well. It was very exciting. We developed something out of nothing. We'd got it to be an industry standard, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But the company wanted to invest in DAB and 11 million in cash, which was what GTN were offering for a business which probably made us £500,000 in profit a year, maybe 700,000, was an incredible offer. So we took the offer.
So, what is DAB? DAB is a whole new way of broadcasting and receiving the radio signals that you and I know and love. The main advantages come from using binary digits or bits, rather than an old-style analog signal.
We took that money, together with raising some money and going public, which we did in 2000, we decided that we would become involved in the DAB revolution. I was a big fan of the technology, but I was a fan of the technology for different reasons than it turned out the rest of the industry was a fan of the technology. I was always a fan of DAB for its ability to take radio into an era of multimedia interactive communication.
There's the prospect of text, data, and even pictures.
My view of a DAB radio was that it should be internet connected, that it should be able to allow you to get information, to buy music, to do all, you know, there are a lot of things that we developed along the way and spent a lot of money developing things in DAB. The DigiZone, those famous DAB radios that looked like something come off Mars, the Wayfinder produced by Pure, all of that. If I look back on that now, that was a really, let's be honest, that was a really failed attempt to make DAB into radio in the connected world. And it didn't happen. Now, did it not happen because that wasn't the right thing for DAB? Who knows? it certainly didn't happen because the radio industry didn't see that as being the future of DAB. They saw the future of DAB as being more radio stations in the same marketplace. Again, we've now gone full circle and all of those radio stations have been closed down, cascaded back into single brands, etc., etc. We now have an industry with effectively multiple transmission platforms of the same thing. Should we have done it at all? I prefer that question to be answered by others. I don't think I'm the right person to give a perspective on DAB. I saw it from the inside. I think I would simply say it's a technology that most of the world hasn't adopted. It's a technology which has burdened the industry with transmission costs for no real benefit. It is a better transmission technology than FM. And now we have it. We've got something that other countries don't have. But I don't think you could argue that economically it's improved the radio industry. And at the end of the day, and I'm speaking now purely from a commercial radio point of view, a technology that doesn't improve the economic model is not a technology that has any place. I believe there are ways it could have improved the electronic model. I still believe today that the technology we developed, which was called Click, which allowed you to buy a song while you were listening to it, and that was before Spotify, only just after Apple, before the iPhone, I believe things like that would have had an economic model. And I believe now, you know, you've got devices that can do that, but none of the technology in those devices belongs to anybody in the radio industry, and none of the benefits from, you know, recognizing music on radio. Ironically, 7digital, in the last 5 years that I was there, developed a technology which Talpa Radio still uses today and several other stations, which allows you to add songs directly from the radio station to a playlist and then stream them. But none of the radio stations are anything to do with that technology. And I think radio's challenge at the moment is where the radio industry that's existed for the last 30 years in commercial terms, where its economic model fits in the new world of audio is a really open and I find interesting and fascinating question at the moment. And it doesn't fit in linear streams on broadcast media where somebody else is picking the songs and there are commercials in between them. That isn't it. That's an important part of it, and I don't think that's ever going to go away, but that isn't it.
Maybe it's time to have the first reading from the Rule of Claw and let our listeners in on what we've been talking about.
OK, this is a passage where the boys have started to take control of the...
During our decision to take part in, you know, the development of DAB, we did want to be involved in content as well, but we wanted to be involved in content which, again, was differentiated. We didn't see any point in, you know, having more pop music radio stations with a slightly different format. Tim came up with the idea of One Word, and we took it to Ralph Bernard and Quentin for the new digital one, and it went in as part of the pitch for the multiplex, which they then won. It was very innovative, and Tim, together with a man called Ben Budworth, did some really innovative licensing deals with audiobook publishers that gave them a share of royalties when we sold advertising. But it was always going to be a really tough slog to get that to be listened to and to monetize, etc., etc. And we went to see the BBC, and this is public knowledge because it became part of a report that was done into the BBC's development of digital at that period. We went to see the BBC and we said, can we have access to your archive? Because we would like to use One Word to monetize the BBC's spoken word archive. You're not using it at the moment, so why don't you let us and we'll pay you? They said no. We felt that was incredibly unjust because we felt that this archive belonged to the license fee payer and should be shown. And we were obviously successful in persuading them to do that because they then launched effectively their own version of One Word. And from the point they did that, a tiny marketplace was being split. And the BBC didn't need to make money doing it, and we did, and we weren't going to. So it became pretty plain that One Word did not have a commercial future. And our co-investors, Guardian Media Group, and we agreed that the game was up at that point. And the BBC were criticised for effectively killing an embryonic digital service. I'll say this, I think they did, but, you know, that's life. You know, we were unsuccessful in persuading the BBC to do what we wanted to do, and they did their own thing. Now, you know, politicians can argue whether the BBC should do that or not, and whether the BBC should put its mark in commercial markets. I think that's a difficult argument. I certainly don't think we want to end up with a BBC that simply does what the commercial world won't do. That simple model, which is the North American public service model, doesn't work. Good public service broadcasting has to have a popular element. I don't think in that instance we failed. I think we had a really good idea, and I think Radio 4 Extra today is probably what one word could have been.
As you probably know by now, BBC Radio 7 is becoming BBC Radio 4 Extra. If you like your comedy dished up early, good news from Monday.
Audio Boom came out of Channel 4 Radio. One of our digital radio investments was in Channel 4 Radio, and we were there to be the innovators. And we were there to develop technologies alongside Channel 4 Radio on the second national multiplex that would deliver interactivity. One of those technologies was the opportunity to listen again effectively and to have a connected device where the internet would allow you to podcast streaming. The technology was invented by a man called Mark Rock.
I think the main kind of spark of the idea, quite a sad one in a way, so my mum died, and when you kind of lose that significant other, or the first one, you kind of realise there's a whole bunch of memories are gone, and people don't very easily carry audio recorders around.
When Channel 4 Radio folded, Channel 4 and we put £40,000 each into trying to productise this technology, and paid Mark Rock to do that, and he did that, and that became Audio Boo, as it was at the time. And we continued to be investors in it. Channel 4 dropped out of that investment because there were changes at Channel 4. Andy, the boss of Channel 4, stepped down, etc., etc. We then became large investors in Audio Boom. And UBC was beginning to be viewed as a stock market player because of its ownership of Audio Boom, which was only 50%, rather than because of our ownership of production companies. Because the production companies never really lit up the fire of the stock market, but Audio Boom did. So when we did the reverse into Seven Digital, we decided we had to give Audio Boom its own head. Now, rather than selling Audio Boom, what we did was we pushed it into a cash shell on AIM and gave it its own listing. That was very successful to start with, and we took something approaching 10 million out of the sale of our stake in Audio Boom. Ironically, our investment in Audio Boom was probably the most successful thing we ever did in digital radio.
Mobile phones could create great audio. You could add additional metadata like a photo or location or titles, which made it more searchable on the internet.
That whole digital radio thing got me into dealing with technology companies, dealing with interactivity, and led to my fascination with that as the way audio would develop in the future, that, you know, we would move away from linear broadcast to a much more interactive model, which clearly is what we are doing now. But equally clearly, we're doing it now, but it still hasn't been worked out how that's going to happen and where and who the winners and losers are. Spotify, the BBC, commercial radio, Audio Boom, Podcast One, Acast. Just like in the music industry, you've got a traditional value chain that's being massively disrupted. The pieces in the value chain go up in the air and they come down in a different order. At the moment, they're coming down, and I don't think we know what the order is. We are going through a fascinating period in media. Probably, you know, look at the great transitions in the past. Invention of radio, medium wave to FM, FM to digital. None of those periods are anything like the change that's going on now. You know, the economic model changing in commercial radio in the late 80s, that's nothing compared with what's going on now. We are going through the most fundamental reinvention of the way people consume audio that we've had since broadcasting was invented.
Hello CQ, this is 2MR Talk, this is 2MR Talk calling.
I decided when I turned 60 that I was running a company where the average age of the employees was 32, and the energy required to do that was, I was finding, exhausting. It was a bad time to leave from that point of view. There was business undone. But on the other hand, you're a human being and you've got X number of years in your life, and you get to a stage where You know, you are painfully reminded by the things that happen to people you love around you that there's a timetable here. Had I been doing that when I was 30, would I have found that as frustrating? I'm not sure. And I think that's probably the end of my period of running a thing. I am still fascinated in the way the market is developing. I'm involved in a company called Melody VR, which is doing some exciting things in music and virtual reality. And going back to what I said earlier, I've learned from failures in my life, and I've learned what I'm good at and what I'm not good at. And I think where I'm at my best is when I'm excited by disruption, new opportunity, new technology, and I think VR is absolutely nascent at the moment. Nobody really knows where it's going to go, and Melody has a really interesting offering. You know, basically you get to go to a concert in VR when the concert's sold out. So I think that's interesting. There are some other people I'm talking to at the moment. I'm not in a hurry to put together some great portfolio of things. I would like the opportunity to spend a bit more time to myself. I think I realise, looking back, how exhausted I was, and I'm enjoying being less exhausted. Most importantly, I think, you know, I want the next period of my life to be the same kind of change as the other chapters that I've turned. But I haven't said one thing which is the most important. The most significant person in my business life is Tim Blackmore. And the biggest lesson that I learned in 25 years working together, during which we never had an argument, is that the most lucky thing you can have is find somebody to work with who perfectly complements your character, who makes up for your failures and you make up for theirs. And I was incredibly lucky having that with Tim. I am rich in having worked with amazing people and having done some incredible things. Did I think I would be rich in that respect when I graduated in drama? Not in a million years. If you remember, I thought I was going to be a producer at Radio 2. Would a producer at Radio 2 have been intellectually as rich as the life I've enjoyed? No. I'm incredibly lucky, therefore, to have done all of those different things and to have the richness of intellectual experience, pluses, minuses, failures, successes, friends, enemies, over that period. Incredibly lucky. And that's rich for me. That's wealth.
Simon Cole. For more editions of Radio Moments Conversations, follow the podcast.